A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Wild Tales Podcast. I'm Jason Fox, and this series is all about adventure, resilience, and inspirational humans. The podcast is presented by the Book of Man, and in partnership with Talisker, a single malt whiskey made by the sea. My guest today is Leveson Wood, the explorer, writer and photographer. He's a British Army major who has gone on to achieve incredible things in the world of adventure and conservation, becoming a best-selling author and fronting documentaries like the recent Walking with Elephants. In the episode, we answer some questions that you've asked me on Instagram. I'm going to be sending a bottle of Talisker to the top question. In addition, malts.com are offering a 10% off promo code Talisker15DE, redeemable at checkout on www.malts.com until the 30th of November 2020. Discount may only be used once for individual Talisker Distillers edition products for sale at £100 or less. No minimum spend, but a delivery charge may apply. Not to be used in conjunction with any other offer, gift card purchases are excluded. 18 plus and subject to malts.com terms of sale. Here we go, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Leveson, welcome. I am genuinely actually looking forward to this because I have got this podcast has got the potential to last a very long time because there's just too much to talk about. It can't. So I'm trying to try and keep things as in very interesting but very brief as well, because you could basically talk for hours on each one of your amazing adventures, because
thanks for having me on. It's it'll be good to chat to you.
So let's crack on. But because of the times we're in, and I know this gets boring as fuck now, but how has the pandemic affected you? What have you been up to?
So the first few months, I have to say, the first 2 weeks, I was like, oh dear, right, this is going to really play havoc with not only like plans, but, you know, this is the first time I've probably stayed still for more than like 3 weeks in my entire adult life. So, but after a few weeks, you know, I kind of got into a bit of a routine, and I shouldn't say enjoy it, but I kind of appreciated the novelty of being at home, cracking on with jobs that I'd put off for ages, and tried to embrace it. You know, I did a bit of a cliche and got a lockdown puppy. He's now not small. He's a huge Rhodesian Ridgeback. But it's been all right, actually. And it's only really since probably September that I've started to really get itchy feet again. And I'm definitely ready for another adventure now.
Well, Ridgebacks are awesome, by the way. I love them, dog. What's his name?
His name's Byron. He's massive. He's the size of a small ginger horse.
Right, mate. We're going to go back to the young Leveson. Where did you grow up and what was it like?
So I grew up in Stoke-on-Trent in the early 80s. Both my parents are teachers. You know, they grew up in council houses. Yeah. Went to a state school. Pretty, I wouldn't say a rough upbringing, but it was, you know, it certainly wasn't particularly, extravagant. Camping holidays in Wales, that sort of thing. And I think that gave me a lot of inspiration to leave home at quite a young age. And I was desperate to go and see the world. I knew I wanted to join the army since I was probably about 10. My granddad was in the war. He fought in Burma, and I kind of grew up on his stories and adventures from the Far East, really. And my dad was in the TA. So it was kind of, the military was definitely a route that I was exploring from a really young age. But as I sort of got to about 17, 18, I knew there was a big wide world out there. And I kind of was umming and ahhing whether to join the army straight away or go to university. And I ended up sort of procrastinated by taking a gap year. Now, it's very popular these days to go off traveling, but you know, in those days, I certainly didn't know anyone that had done it. Certainly nobody in Stoke-on-Trent that I knew had been away on a gap year. Cause it just, you know, so I went and worked for a bit and earned enough money and off I went. And it was a really formative trip because I did a, you know, just a lot of hitchhiking, backpacking around, but it stayed with me, that a really positive experience. So after I finished university, I took another gap year. I think I've been on a big long gap year ever since, really. But but all those early travels that I did when I was sort of, you know, in my late teens, early 20s, when I was a student, were incredible because I did it on such a shoestring budget because I had to, because I didn't have any money, that it kind of forced me to go and rely on the hospitality of others. I hitchhiked to India once when I was 21. All the way from Nottingham on a budget of 500 quid, which doesn't sound plausible, but 500 quid, which lasted me for 5 months. And that was because I was sleeping rough. I was just sleeping, you know, at the side of the road. If people invited me into their homes, I'd go in. I was eating one meal a day, if that. And it was just bloody brilliant. And it taught me a lot about self-reliance, about independence, and about trust, and about what risk really means. Because I think a lot of the problems that stem from today are about people not really understanding risk and people getting the knickers in a twist about silly things that don't actually matter or they're not particularly dangerous, and forgetting the sort of the far greater risk of leading a very dull and boring life. And I determined to not do that from a very young age.
Mate, so basically your gap year consisted of living like John Rambo.
It wasn't far off in parts of Russia, I tell you.
You're a vagrant.
Yeah, but no, it was a really interesting experience, and one that stayed with me. And I've tried to take that ethos of living frugally, of, you know, accepting the kindness of strangers and looking for the best in people, I think, wherever I've gone since then. And it's the kind of same mentality that I've tried to take with me in the travels that I do now.
Yeah. Well, just weirdly, over the last month, maybe the last month, 6 weeks, nearly every other person I've met is from Stoke.
Get off.
I don't know what's happened over the last 6 weeks, but I keep gravitating towards people that are obviously from Stoke. It's bizarre. Mate, you joined the army. You chose the paras,
yeah,
which was obviously a very, very good choice and an amazing unit of individuals. What made you join the paras?
So this was quite a funny story. So when I was at Sandhurst, you're given, I think you get initially three choices, and I put down my local regiment, which was the Staffords.
Yeah,
and the Ink Corps, because I was a bit of a, you know, I thought, okay, well, what's the most sort of the opposite of the infantry, I suppose, and I fancied, you know, at least exploring the idea of the Ink Corps, and so I had those two down as my choices, and then I boxed at Sandhurst. So I remember, you know, there was about however many people start the boxing, and then it dwindles down to fight night when you're selected on, if you've shown the commitment to turning up for all the training sessions, and two, if you've got somebody in the right weight category. So I was very fortunate to be selected for the fight night, won my fight, and everyone that boxed for the first time gets to go to the sergeant's mess, which for a young officer cadet is quite a daunting experience. But it's the first time that you actually see your platoon, you know, your DS and all the staff as other humans rather than these big ogres. And they invite you into the mess, and you have a few pints. And actually the Parareg rep was there, and he came up to me and he said, oh, you know, I enjoyed your fight. Well done on winning. Why aren't you joining the Paras? And I said, well, I just didn't know whether I'd be good enough to get in the Paras, frankly. And he said, right. He said, sit down. So I sat down. And he gave me the Paras interview there and then, asking me all about, you know, current affairs, mental arithmetic, and I was like, God knows. Anyway, I passed this test. He said, right, 6 a.m. I want you in my office for the second round of interviews. Bear in mind, they'd already selected the 12 cadets to get through to the final stage from about 80 applicants at this stage. For the parachute regiment.
Right, okay.
And I got fast tracked to the final 12 from that interview. And And then, yeah, luckily I got through. And you know what? It was, I kind of, it's interesting when you look in hindsight and join all these dots together. But I think perhaps if I hadn't won that boxing match, if I hadn't won that fight, if I hadn't turned up for all those training sessions, I wouldn't have joined the Paras and I probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now.
Yeah. Well, where did you, so after Sandhurst, where did you go? Which battalion did you go to?
So after Sandhurst and then doing all of like the, you know, two kind of battle course, P Company and all the rest of it, ended up in 3 para just as they were getting back from Operic 6. So as you can imagine, that was quite a tough time to take over a platoon. That was the first big scrapping that had happened in, you know, best part of a generation. And and then I suddenly was given 30 battle-hardened paratrooper veterans. So
yeah, they had quite a tough, they had a tough tour, didn't they?
That, we did. It was
So where were you then? Was that in Dover?
No, I think that was in Colchester. So I basically had 18 months. It was another rotation. So basically we had 18 months, started from scratch, went through the whole pre-deployment training before going out on Herrick 8. By which time, you know, I think everyone was ready for it again, and I certainly was. I was keen to get out to Afghanistan. I'd already hitchhiked across it when I was 22, but it was interesting to go back, obviously, under a different guise.
So what year did you hitchhike across it then? When you
2004.
Yeah, that is meant. We need to go right. We're going to go back. Actually, this is we're not going forward. So in 2004. Was this on your hitchhike to India?
Yeah, so this is when I was hitchhiking to India. I went through, I went all the way through Russia, over the Caucasus, through like Chechnya and all that, into Turkey, hitchhiked across Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, over the Khyber Pass, and then finished up in India. Incredible trip.
What was it? I mean, to be fair, Afghan's not even that bad compared to some of those when you think about Chechnya and whatnot. But what was it? Which bits of Afghan did you?
So I came in from the Iranian border over into Herat.
Yeah.
And then obviously there you kind of face with three choices. You go the northern route, which is a pretty long and winding route through Badakhshan and all that. Or you go the southern route through Kandahar, which even though it was before it really kicked off, everyone was advising against going that southern route.
Yeah.
So I decided to go straight across the middle through Ghor province, Chagchiran, Bamiyan, all the way to Kabul that way, and so through the sort of Tajik and Hazara areas.
That's all. I mean, I consider myself lucky because of I have seen a reasonable amount of Afghan because of who I was with at the time, but not on that level. And those places are it is an awesome place, isn't it? It's a misunderstood place.
It is, and it's incredibly beautiful. You know, I mean, it was, you know, the mountains up there are just so spectacular. I was there, I think it was sort of, it was awesome. It was about this time, this sort of time of the year, and it was covered in snow. And like I say, I got, at this point, I'd literally, when I say I got no money, I got to Iran and used all my final dollars. And I think I'd got one final traveler's check that was supposed to get me through to India, but you can't use traveler's checks in Iran. So I'd had to like just beg, borrow and steal in Iran. So by the time I got to Afghanistan, I was literally had about $4 to my name. So I was carrying on hitchhiking. And luckily the Afghans are incredibly hospitable. And if they see you're hungry, and anyway, it was Ramadan. So I didn't, you couldn't really eat anyway. So that wasn't really too much of an issue, but just going into these villages and just hoping for the best was probably a lot of people would say it might be a little bit reckless, and I probably wouldn't do it now and you know, at my age. But as a 21, 22 year old, looking for a bit of an adventure, it was incredible. And actually I was looked after. I ended up staying in this Mujahideen sort of fighter's house with his 9 brothers, and he put me up for like a week.
That is bonkers. It's awesome, but it's just like, just to put that into perspective for people that are listening, that was in 2004. Bear in mind, in 2001 is when it actually did kick off. I know it went through a period, there was a sort of a lull, I suppose.
I'd say, yeah, 2003, 4, 5 was probably the lull. So if there was ever a safe time to go, that was probably it. But
that's, I mean, how, What was it like going back with the parachute as an army officer? In the did it sway your opinions on how you were going to do business, or did it help you chatting to people?
It did. I mean, I had to be a bit careful around some of my colleagues because they didn't see any sense in why on earth I would have hitchhiked there in the first place. So I didn't really announce the fact that I'd been there on sort of what they thought of as a holiday. But from a personal perspective, I found it gave me a bit of perspective. I did a lot of reading about the place and read up about the history and the great game. And you know, my degree at university was all about colonial history. So I'd already sort of got a reasonable understanding of what the British Army had been up to there in the 1800s and so on. So I think it just gave me a bit more of a perspective and an understanding of the culture more than anything else. And hopefully a bit more empathy with the local people as well.
Yeah. It can only be a good thing, can't it, really, to be honest. Okay, so we are going to move because we could talk about that for bloody yonks, but what we're going to do now is move on to the Himalayas. So that was an undertaking, to say the least. But how did you transition from an army officer, parachute regiment? What happened? How did you become this person that now basically is the person that travels and walks everywhere on TV?
So I left the reg back in 2010. and I was ready for a new challenge. I wanted to do something a bit more. I don't know. I kind of missed the travel for the travel's sake a bit. And ended up volunteering for a charity in Africa for about 12 months. And to cut a very long story short, the experiences that I had in Africa inspired me to set up an expedition company. So me and a mate from the Paras, we set up a little company called Secret Compass, which specialised in doing...
That's Tom, isn't it?
Tom Bodkin, yeah, exactly. So we set this company up, and the idea was to sort of apply the military... model of AT and expeditions and open it up to a civvy market. So we ended up taking people we took people horse riding across north and northeastern Afghanistan, the Wakhan Corridor. We took camel riding across the Sudan. We went mountain climbing in on the Iran-Iraq border. So all these places that people think you can't go to, actually you can, with a bit of planning and preparation. And that did really well. And that kind of, it's, we start getting lots of interest from TV people and the like. Yeah. And I was just experimenting with different hobbies and passions. So I was doing a bit of photography and writing bits for magazines and newspapers. And it kind of all just came together until one day I was chatting to a director, and he said, look, have you got any ideas? And we'll put you in front of the camera. And that wasn't something that I'd ever contemplated. It wasn't something I was looking for, but I thought it's a good opportunity. Why not?
Yeah.
So I suggested walking the Nile as the first one because it had never been done. And so that was it. That got commissioned. That was back in 2013. And I spent 9 months walking the length of the River Nile from the Congo-Rwanda border all the way to Egypt. And that was quite an epic undertaking. Yeah. And then I sort of had, with no idea whether or not, one, it was possible, two, I was up to it, and three, if I'd come back alive, you know, and I was kind of lucky to do all three, really. And then once that happened, that really sort of, that changed my life forever, because it's, you know, once you're on TV, there's no real going back, I suppose. And luckily it was a big success. Wrote a book off the back of it. And then the TV people kept, you know, they wanted more. So off the back of that, I've done 6 subsequent TV series. I've written, you know, 8 more books, and it's been a bit of a roller coaster ride ever since.
So is it a bit, I mean, I'm going to jump around again, but are you still involved with Secret Compass?
No, so I sold my bit to Tom Bodkin after the NAR, just because I was too busy sort of with the TV side of things. So, but they're still running you know, expeditions and
I've got to say I've worked with Tom and that Secret Compass is awesome. That's not a weird plug. They're very good at what they do. So yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it was a good, like I say, for me, it was an incredible opportunity to just learn how to apply the military mindset to the civilian mindset. It was a great transition. You know, we learned a lot in those early days. Yeah.
Yeah. The Nile is when you think about the countries that it runs through, that is an absolutely mental undertaking. But where did the idea for the Himalayas come from? Was it off the back end of that?
Off the back end of the Nile. So the Nile for me was, you know, one of my specialities that I'd studied was, like I say, colonial history. And of course, East Africa was a big part of that. So I was already interested in places like Sudan and Egypt. And then I thought, why not taking a similar idea of traveling on foot along a geographical phenomenon? What's the next, I suppose, biggest thing in terms of people's imaginations? What strikes a chord? And the Himalayas, of course, is this, you know, this enormous mountain range that stretches all across Central Asia. Why not walk the length of that as well? And I knew it would take me through some interesting countries. And I thought, where better place to start than the back in Afghanistan? So I started up in the Wakhan corridor for that one. And then went from there into Pakistan, Kashmir, India, Nepal, Bhutan, and then finished on the Tibet border. And that was another sort of, what was that? It's about 2,800 miles. That took another 6 months. So yeah, it was a bit of a beast as well.
So what year was that you did the Himalayas?
That was 5 years ago. Yeah. 2015 that was. And that wasn't without its problems. I mean, halfway through the trip, the irony being that I was in Nepal and they were having a bit of trouble with the Maoists there. So there were certain areas that were off limits and we were in one of those areas. And we were told by the local sort of villagers that we weren't allowed to camp in this village. So they stuck us in a taxi and sort of sent us packing to the next town, which was a couple of miles away. And it was late at night. And just as we were going over the top of this mountain pass, the brakes failed in this taxi and it went plummeting off the edge of a 400 foot cliff with me in it. And very, very lucky to survive, God knows how, because the car rolled about 10 times and my arm was sort of completely mangled in the wrong direction. But that was a real awakening, because that was probably the closest to that I've come to really copping it.
But you have had a few close shaves though, haven't you, on most trips that you've done?
There's been plenty of close shaves, but I think that's what people, going back to what I was saying earlier about the concept of risk, it's rarely the sort of getting shot at or the getting snapped at by crocodiles or you know, all those things. I mean, they happen, of course, and they're all dangerous, but they're far less frequent than the more boring and mundane threats, which is always going to be getting in some dodgy taxi where, you know, the chance of a road traffic accident is always there. And, you know, like I say, that's probably the third big accident I've had now. And that's far more common than anything else.
Wasn't there one? Did you have one in South America?
I had one in a big one in Afghanistan, one in Sudan, and a few other minor ones along the way.
All right. It's difficult to know where to go because there's so much stuff that goes on and happens. But like, so people listening, how do you go about planning these trips? Take months. Like, where do you start? What is your start point?
Start point, I think, like with any good idea, it's usually over a few pints in the pub, really. I mean, that's usually where the sort of ideas are generated. Sometimes they come as a result of a light bulb moment. Sometimes it's just that, you know, I've got an interest in an area and then figuring out an interesting route. And I think it all begins with just being confident that you can make stuff happen. Doesn't matter how ridiculous it might sound, you come up with an idea and then worry about the finer details later. And I remember when I pitched an idea once to travel from the Black Sea to the Caspian, from Russia to Iran, and go, you know, retracing part of the route that I did when I was 21, 20.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Two.
Yeah.
Through like Chechnya, everyone thought it was absolutely bonkers, but we managed to pull it off. And so I think it's, yeah, it, these trips often take 4, 5, 6 months of planning. They're often quite expensive. You need the right team, and I've got a great team of guys that I've been working with.
Yeah.
You know, and you know how this works, Jace, when you've got, you know, people that you trust around you, and that's essential. It's not a one man show. It's not just me out there with my rucksack and my boots. You know, I've got two or three people that come with me, not all the time. You know, I'd say, you know, probably sort of 50% of the time I'm just on my own with local people, local guides. But then, you know, the crew, which is usually never more than, we always try and keep it to one car's worth, so that if the shit hits the fan, we can get out of there. You know, they're there to sort of help out along the way.
Yeah. Do you ever get the prep slightly wrong? Has there ever been moments where you're like, ah, shit, we've either missed something or we've overthought something?
I'd say, you know, you can't always plan for every eventuality. Obviously, you have to leave some things to best guess. And I'd probably say the best example of that was a trip that I did 2.5 years ago. So I've done the Nile, the Himalayas, walking the Central America from Russia to Iran, from Mexico to Colombia, and then I sometimes get confused with the order, but I remember going from Mexico to Colombia. We were in Honduras, and I don't know, have you been to San Pedro Sula?
No.
In Honduras. So there's this city which I know you've spent a bit of time with the narcos and that lot, sort of in that neck of the woods.
Yeah.
We went to San Pedro Sula, which was at one point, I can't remember which year it was, sort of 2015, 2016. It was like, you know, they all claim to be most dangerous city in the world, don't they? But this one was the area where the two main gangs, which is MS-13 and Barrio 18.
Yeah.
Are sort of rival gangs, and we got to this city, and to walk across the city you've got to go through both areas, and we'd approached lots of people, the army, the police, and they all said, look, don't ask us, we just don't go there. We don't even go there, so we can't help you. So we ended up having to like go, and we ask around, and we found this local guy who happened to be like he was a village preacher, he was like a pastor, and he said, look, I can get you in, no problem. And we thought, okay. And this guy was, he got his two mobile phones out, and he called up the two rival gang leaders, who both of whom were in jail at the time, and they were running their respective gangs from the jail cells. And it was fascinating because this guy was like, look, we've got this gringo here, and he wants to walk through your areas, and you know, he's not from any like big broadcaster. He's just making a sort of documentary. And can they come through? And he said, well, what are the other guys doing? So he spoke to the other gangs, and these were like, and they were kind of, it was weird because it was playing them off against each other. And one of them was like, yeah, you can come into our areas. We'll show it off. And so the other gang leader was like, okay, well, he can come into our areas. And then they agreed this sort of handover in the middle. And it was one of those bizarre things because they both said, okay, well, you can come into our areas, but just give us 24 hours because we want to make sure that we clean up the graffiti and pick up all the litter. I mean, it was just bonkers. But I have to say, that was a proper heart-in-mouth moment where we were walking through these areas and you see these kids who are like 11, 12 years old, covered in tattoos, you know, pistol down their pants, no, completely lawless. And these kids were showing us around what they called the Casa Loca, the crazy house, which is where they go and torture rival gang members. And there was like nooses hanging from the ceilings, there was bullet holes everywhere, blood stains. I mean, it was just so surreal. And to be walking around there with these like murderous, you know, was this like the right decision to be here with absolutely no backup from anybody, you know? But I think there's those moments that you think, yeah, you start to brick it.
It's mental, isn't it? But I think, do you know what? I think sometimes because you haven't got any,
yeah,
backup,
a lot of threats, you weren't armed or anything like that, and it does mean that you get far better access.
What would you say has been the most difficult one of your adventures, journeys?
I'd say difficult, probably going back to the Nile, I'd say. And that stays with me for lots of reasons, not least because it was the one that I did. It was the first big one that I did where I had, you know, like I said before, I didn't know whether it was physically possible. Didn't know whether I could walk that amount of miles. And then something happened about a third of the way in that kind of like really brought it home. So an American journalist called Matthew Power was sent out by an American magazine to write about the trip, to write about me. I didn't know him personally at the time, but you know, he was a lovely guy, and he started walking with me, and sadly, on after just like a couple of days, passed away. He died. You know, when you've got somebody die in your arms like that, it really brings home the seriousness of this, and makes you really question, you know, is it really worth it? And we had to sort of, me and my local guy Boston, we were sort of had a good few days of solid thinking whether or not it was the right thing to do to carry on. And we thought, yeah, we should really, because if we don't, then this whole thing's gone to waste really. So, yeah. But it's something that, it brings into it, you know, into the front of your mind, how severe these things can be.
How did you actually deal with that? As in like, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but emotionally that's something to deal with, but also like administrationally, it's
on that
commission as well, maybe.
So it was, yeah, I mean, it was in the middle of nowhere. It was a bloody long day. We had to carry his body out of the bush for quite a number of miles. We had to arrange, you know, speak with, it took days of, you know, arranging with the local police what to do. I had to call his wife. It was just an absolute nightmare in every sense, you know, it really was. So, yeah. And then obviously dealing with the fallout afterwards, it was a big thing. And it brings everything into question.
Yeah. Obviously I knew about it, but you know, now talking about it, it makes you think about that whole situation a little bit more deeper, I suppose. But yeah, so that the most difficult one. What would you say is your most favourite?
Favourite. Well, one in terms of just sheer fun, I think. And I've just talked about the gangs and the sort of the slightly more dangerous parts of walking the Americas, but that was really made incredible because I was with this guy called Alberto. Now I just when I started this trip, I was in a pretty sort of dark place myself. He just got divorced, so we're two miserable blokes basically walking out of Mexico heading south for 6 months. But he was just such good fun, and he had such a sense of humor. We ended up just having loads of fun along the way, actually. And I think that goes to show, if you're with good company, you can kind of make the best of a shitty situation. But I think the one I'm most proud of, I think, is the trip that I did around the Arabian Peninsula. So
yeah,
this was a trip that I'd been wanting to do for 5 years. After the Nile, it was like, oh, it was either the Himalayas or I personally wanted to go back to the Middle East because it was a region that I'd been fascinated by a long time. a region that I'd just been just interested in the culture and the history. But nobody wanted it. You know, I pitched it to all the big names and everyone's like, nah, nobody cares about the Middle East. That's just current affairs. That's news. Nobody wants to go and see it, you know, from that perspective, which I just thought was a real shame and a real disappointment, actually, because people weren't willing to open their minds to looking at something from a different perspective. So I was determined to do it anyway. So I said, right, well, if nobody wants to commission it, I'm just going to go and do it. And so I did. So I got two of my mates, the guys that had sort of been with me as co-producers on previous journeys, and set up my own production company. We all chucked in some money and went and did it ourselves. And it was a really rewarding trip. And we ended up winning. We ended up getting shortlisted for like a broadcast award and all sorts of stuff off the back of it. So it was a good bit of vindication against the sort of powers that be in many ways. But in terms of the trip, it was amazing because we went to places. We went up to northern Syria, it's Rojava. We're embedded with some of the militias in Iraq on like the last battles against ISIS. we went through Yemen, which was completely off limits at that time. We managed to get the first tourism visa into Saudi Arabia ever, I think. Went through Lebanon with Hezbollah. We went through Western Syria with the Russians. I mean, it was just bonkers. The whole thing was just, you know, crazy. But, you know, to go and see it at that time, to be in those moments and see all these really historic things happening, and to take calculated risks and be bold, but also measured. You know, everything we did on that trip was considered and measured, and we got away with it. And we got away with it because it was properly planned and done properly with the right people.
Yeah, that was, I do remember it. I mean, because obviously one of the guys you were talking about is Tom Cross, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a shame. I find it a shame as well that wasn't initially picked up, but it's also, I'm glad that it was a bit of a fuck you to the powers that be. That's a good thing to come out of it, I suppose. For all these trips, what is it? What do you keep in mind? How do you keep your sort of like resilience going? Because you've spoken about, you know, the distances walked, the environments, the terrains, the people dying as well, unfortunately. You know, what is it that you keep in the back of your mind to keep yourself going?
I mean, at the most sort of flippant angle, it would be, it's better than having a real job, isn't it? I think it's like genuinely a sense of, I just feel really bloody lucky that I get to do this for a job. And so it makes it all worthwhile. All the struggles and all the inconveniences and everything else are small fry because I get to do this amazing job that I really, really love. And that, luckily for me, the sense of curiosity hasn't sort of worn off. You know, we all get a bit jaded now and again. But, you know, I still love traveling. I still go into new places and meeting interesting people. And I do. I think that's the great bit is I get to meet mega people all over the world. Yeah. and do things and I'm my own boss and I get to choose, you know, what trips I do. All the sort of ideas have been mine and I really enjoy that and building new things and being creative, I think. And I have to pinch myself when I sort of sometimes when I think, you know, I've written 8 books, I'm sort of working on 9 and 10 at the minute. And I just think I feel it's not pride because, you know, there's any number of elements of luck along the way, but at the same time, as long as I can keep doing this stuff, I think it's kind of my responsibility and duty to myself and my friends that I should keep going and making the most of it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a personal sort of question. What's your, you've written 8 books, you've got more coming. Do you enjoy that part of it as well? Do you enjoy the bit where you get to put pen to paper and almost, it's another way of reliving the experiences you've already had?
Yeah, so the writing actually was something that I wanted to do, you know, before TV. Like I say, TV almost came along a bit by accident, whereas the writing was something I was already passionate about. You know, I sort of already sort of done a bit with my degree at university, and so it wasn't a massive leap to then be writing books. But the hard bit, of course, is getting them published. You know, there's lots of good writers out there, but it's just sometimes very difficult to convince other people that they're worth reading. So obviously TV makes that a lot easier, doesn't it? So the two go hand in hand. But I really enjoy the, because the TV, obviously, the side of the shows and the documentaries are obviously edited to meet the sort of the requirements of TV, whereas with the books I get a lot more freedom myself to tell the sort of behind the scenes stories and my own motivations, and I actually really enjoy writing, and I've written all my own books, and just really enjoy that process of coming up with an idea and then how many months later seeing it in a book form. It's very rewarding.
Yeah. What so we've obviously gone through this bonkers year of 2020. It's been a bit of a weird place. What have you been planning whilst we've been locked down, and you know, what's next for you?
Well, I had loads of trips that have all been cancelled this year, so I mean, I'm hoping that some of them will get, you know, well, you know, who knows when this thing will end, but I'd like to think that come the spring, or certainly next summer, that we'll be traveling again. I've got a couple of other, you know, expedition ideas that I'd like to do. I've this year, in between the, you know, the various lockdowns and just before, I took up paramotoring. Actually, I'd always, but bizarrely, for being a para, I'd always had a bit of a fear of turbulence. I didn't like flying, so I thought that's just nonsense. I need to get over that. So I thought the best way to do it would be to start doing paramotoring. Which I did. So I did it. I started in Chamonix in January, and then I've done it in between the lockdowns in the UK, and so I'm doing a bit more of that, and I might try and integrate some of that into my expeditions rather than just walking. Feet get a bit tired now.
I've heard about this paramotoring this lot. Can you explain a little bit about that?
It's great fun. So it's like paragliding, but rather than, you don't need a mountain, you can take off anywhere, basically, a bit of flat land. Right. So you've got this big fan strapped to your back, basically a big lawnmower fan. And you know, it's great. It's really, really easy to learn. And it means that you can, you know, do these quite cool cross-country trips without the need to have any hills, basically. You know, two of my mates did it with very little experience. They ended up flying across Australia in like less than 2 weeks, just landing in like you know, petrol stations, filling up again, and off you go. You can fly for another 2-3 hours.
So it's under you've got a canopy. What's the canopy?
Not a canopy, you've just got a normal wing. But then you've got this sort of this little fan strapped to your back with a little two-stroke engine to it.
So how long does the fuel last?
Well, if you've got a sort of full tank and good wind, you can fly for a couple of hours. You can do, if the wind's behind you, you can probably do 300-400 kilometers. So you can do some good distance.
Yeah. But what happens when it runs out of fuel? You don't.
Well, then you try and plan it to your land. You try and plan it to your land before then.
Yeah.
But even if the engine fails, it's just then becomes a paraglider. So if the engine fails at, you know, 2,000 feet, you just then find a spot to land and glide down as you would normally.
It's like a ram air.
It's just a square. Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, it does. I don't know.
Come along, we'll go flying. It's great fun.
The thing is, I'm interested, but again, I'm like you with the whole turbulence thing. Obviously parachuted, and sometimes when you're up there, you go through turbulence, and I'm like, I don't know whether I'm happy about this shit.
I know, but I think there's something quite nice about, because you've got the motor, you can kind of get yourself out of most situations and you feel completely in control. So it's definitely been a lesson for me in like just having a bit of trust in the kit and stuff.
Yeah. It does. I'm intrigued. Maybe I will come. Maybe I've got a thing about heights as well. You know, yeah. I've got a healthy respect for them. I like challenging myself, but maybe that's something I do. Maybe it's something I definitely need to do.
It's definitely helped me. I was the same. I hate heights. Don't like turbulence. Can't really, you know, I'd rather take a train than an aeroplane, but it's definitely helped me get over that a bit.
Right. Okay. So, is that the next thing? Do you think it's going to be?
Well, I do. I mean, it's the problem I found with, I think what what's worked really well with the walking expeditions is that it's relatable. You know, it's everyone with a pair of legs and walks to the shops thinks in their own subconscious that, oh, I could do that. I could walk an aisle. And I think that's what's worked really well is the simplicity. When you start bringing bits of kit into expeditions, then it kind of creates a bit of a barrier between you and the audience. So I don't know whether it's something I'll do on TV, but it's definitely something I really enjoy from just having a bit of fun perspective. And actually, I think that's something I've promised myself a bit, rather than, because it's been so busy with work the last sort of 6-7 years, and it's just been like a bit of a conveyor belt now. It's like, I'll go away, do a trip, get back, write the book, do the speaking tour, plan the next one, off you go. I've not really left much time for actually just having holidays, bit of fun and all the rest of it. So I'm trying to factor that in now and just not take quite so much on.
Yeah.
Okay. So actually this whole, you know, pandemic has given me a bit of time for that, so can't really complain too much.
It's been good for you. Yeah, it slowed you down, which is probably something that you needed, maybe. I don't know. Mate, there's one more question before I then go, and I've got to consult Instagram to find out which question I'm going to ask for someone to win a bottle of Talisca. But what do you hope the lessons that people take away from watching or reading all about your adventures, really, what is it? I think I know the answer, but you know,
I think it comes back to two things, really. One is, and they're both interlinked, one is going back to that sense of appreciating and embracing risk.
Yeah.
I think that places are rarely as dangerous as the news tells you. And we can all achieve far more than we are led to believe. I think that's the first key one. And then linked in with that is having a bit of just faith and trust in other people, actually. Because like I say, I'm still here and I've been walking around some fairly, what we might think as dodgy places. It's like, actually, if you just go and see with your own eyes and experience things yourself, then you'll be often very reassured, and it's definitely restored my faith in humanity a bit by going to places and just seeing just how hospitable people often are. And that's not to say there aren't dangers, there aren't bad people, of course there are, but like the good really outweighs the bad.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. And I'd like to, like, people listening, they should keep revisiting your, you know, the TV shows you've done and your books, because I think there's a danger at the moment that people are being told that risk is something that we shouldn't do. We shouldn't take risk, and it doesn't encourage people to push themselves out of their comfort zone. So I wholeheartedly agree that, you know, if you haven't watched Lev's shows, or even if you have, go and watch them again, because it just shows you that it's worth it. It's worth it because it develops you as an individual, doesn't it?
Definitely. 100%.
Yeah. Mate, right, I'm going to now go into Instagram. Right, there's been a load of questions fired in. So the question that is going to win a bottle of Talisca is Stumatage UK. So that's Stumitage UK. His question is, whilst Leveson is a cool name, it is an unusual one. Where did it come from?
Oh, right. Okay. So it's actually my dad's name.
Right.
His dad's name, his dad's name, and his dad's name. So there's been 5 Leveson Woods, all of whom have been soldiers of some description. And it goes back to the sort of the mid 19th century, when it was the fashion to name your, if you were a peasant working on the land, to name your son after the local aristocrat. So I'm not from aristocratic stock, but I think my great 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 grandfather was probably sort of making pots for the local landlord and named his kids after him. So that's where it comes from. So it's an old sort of Norman French name, and it's kind of just stuck in the family.
That's quite a cool story, and I'm pleased you know the history of your name as well, because that question could have fallen flat as well. Mate, I'm aware of time, so I really appreciate you coming on. I apologise again for the time change.
Quickly. No, my pleasure. Thanks, buddy. Thanks for having me on.
We appreciate it, and it's been great talking to you, and it's also going to make me watch your programmes again.
Nice one. Cheers, mate. Well, thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it. And catch up for a beer after this lockdown's done, eh?
Thanks very much to Leveson, and I hope you all enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already, and follow me and the Book of Man for the latest news. Thanks again to Talisker for supporting this podcast, and thanks to you all for listening. See you again soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.